sinful ways of being. Yet we condemn the addict's stubborn refusal to give up something deleterious to his life or to the life of others. Why do we despise, ostracize, and punish the drug addict when, as a social collective, we share the same blindness and engage in the same rationalizations? To pose that question is to answer it. We despise, ostracize, and punish the addict because we don't wish to see how much we resemble him. In his dark mirror, our own features are unmistakable. We shudder at the recognition. "This mirror is not for us," we say to the addict. "You are different, and you don't belong with us." Ralph's critique, for all its flaws, is too close for comfort. Like the hardcore addict's pursuit of drugs, much of our economic and cultural life caters to people's craving to escape mental and emotional distress. In an apt phrase, Lewis Lapham, longtime publisher of Harper's Magazine, derides consumer markets selling promises of instant relief from the pain of thought, loneliness, doubt, experience, envy, and old age. According to a Statistics Canada study, 31% of working adults aged 19 to 64 consider themselves workaholics, who attach excessive importance to their work and are overdedicated and perhaps overwhelmed by their jobs. They have trouble sleeping, are more likely to be stressed out and unhealthy, and feel they don't spend enough time with their families, reports the Globe and Mail. Work doesn't necessarily give them greater satisfaction, suggested Vishwanath Baba, a professor of human resources and management at McMaster University. These people turn to work to occupy their time and energy, as compensation for what is lacking in their lives, much as the drug addict employs substances. At the core of every addiction is an emptiness based in abject fear. The addict dreads and abhors the present moment. She bends feverishly only towards the next time, the moment when her brain, infused with her drug of choice, will briefly experience itself as liberated from the burden of the past and the fear of the future, the two elements that make the present intolerable. Many of us resemble the drug addict in our ineffectual efforts to fill in the spiritual black hole, the void at the center, where we have lost touch with our souls, our spirit, with those sources of meaning and value that are not contingent or fleeting. Our consumerist, acquisition, action, and image-mad culture only serves to deepen the hole, leaving us emptier than before. The constant, intrusive, and meaningless mind whirl that characterizes the way so many of us experience our silent moments is itself a form of addiction, and it serves the same purpose. One of the main tasks of the mind is to fight or remove the emotional pain, which is one of the reasons for its incessant activity. But all it can ever achieve is to cover it up temporarily. In fact, the harder the mind struggles to get rid of the pain, the greater the pain. So writes Eckhart Tolle. Even our 24/7 self-exposure to noise, emails, cell phones, TV, internet chats, media outlets, music downloads, video games, and nonstop internal and external chatter cannot succeed in drowning out the fearful voices within. Not only do we avert our eyes from the hardcore drug addict to avoid seeing ourselves, we do so to avoid facing our share of responsibility. As we have seen, injection drug use more often than not arises in people who were abused and neglected as young children. The addict, in other words, is not born, but made. His addiction is the result of a situation that he had no influence in creating. His life expresses the history of the multi-generational family system of which he is a part, and his family exists as part of the broader culture and society. In society, as in nature, each microcosmic unit reflects something of the whole. In the case of drug addiction, the sins of entire societies are visited unevenly on minority populations. We know, for example, that a disproportionate number of prisoners incarcerated for drug-related crimes in the jails of the United States are African-American males. In 2002, 45% of the prisoners in U.S. jails were black. And according to the Department of Justice, black males have about a 1 in 3 chance of being jailed at least once in their lives. In federal prisons, an estimated 57% of inmates have been convicted of drug-related crimes. and drug offenders represented the largest source of jail population growth between 1996 and 2002, increasing by 37%. The fate of black youth has much to tell us about the larger society in which their stories unfold. Similarly, there is an extraordinarily high ratio of Native Canadians among my Portland patients and in Canada's drug-using population and prisons. Dr. Robert DuPont, former U.S. drug czar, interprets such facts as flowing from what he calls the tragic vulnerability of traditional cultures to alcohol and drug problems. He describes the present susceptibility of Aboriginal minority populations to addiction as one of the sad paradoxes of the world experience with alcohol and drug abuse. To see Native Americans suffer from the use of alcohol and other drugs, and even cigarettes, or to see similar suffering among Australian Aborigines, is to face the painful reality that traditional cultures are not prepared to withstand exposure to modern drugs and to tolerant values governing drug-taking behaviors. There is perhaps a much more specific and robust cause for minority drug use than tolerant values toward drug-taking. In fact, given the high incarceration rate of minority members, it's hard to see what those tolerant values even are. As the stories of Serena, Celia, and Angela in the first part of this book illustrate, many women who become injection drug users were severely abused in childhood, the vast majority, according to the research. Of those three women, two are Native. It is a fact that over the past several generations, Native female children in Canada have been more likely to suffer sexual abuse in their families of origin than non-natives. That this is so says nothing about the innate nature of Canadian Native peoples. Sexual abuse of young children among tribal peoples living in their natural habitats is virtually non-existent, and so it was with North American Natives before European colonization. The current dismal statistics say everything about the relationship of Aboriginal societies to the dominant culture. The precursor to addiction is dislocation, according to Bruce Alexander, professor of psychology at Simon Fraser University. By dislocation, he means the loss of psychological, social, and economic integration into family and culture, a sense of exclusion, isolation, and powerlessness. Only chronically and severely dislocated people are vulnerable to addiction, he writes. The historical correlation between severe dislocation and addiction is strong. Although alcohol consumption and drunkenness on festive occasions was widespread in Europe during the Middle Ages, and although a few people became inebriates or drunkards, mass alcoholism was not a problem. However, alcoholism gradually spread with the beginnings of free markets after 1500, and eventually became a raging epidemic with the dominance of the free market society after 1800. Dr. DuPont agrees that in pre-modern societies, although substance use to the point of intoxication was permitted, that use was infrequent and managed in families and communities. Stable communities in pre-modern times were the golden age for alcohol and drug use. With the rise of industrial societies came dislocation, the destruction of traditional relationships, extended family, clan, tribe, and village. Vast economic and social changes tore asunder the ties that formerly connected people to those closest to them and to their communities. They displaced people from their homes and shredded the value systems that secured people's sense of belonging in the moral and spiritual universe. The same process is happening around the world as a result of globalization. China is a prime example. That country's breakneck speed industrialization has made it an emerging economic superpower. But the accompanying social dislocation is likely to prove disastrous. Entire villages and towns are being depopulated to make room for megaprojects like the Three Gorges Dam. The pressures of urbanization are cutting millions of people adrift from their connections with land, tradition, and community. The social and psychological results of massive dislocation are not only predictable, they're already obvious. China has had to set up a massive needle exchange program in an attempt to prevent the spread of HIV and other infectious diseases among its rapidly burgeoning addict population. According to the Ministry of Health in Beijing, nearly half of China's estimated 650,000 people living with HIV/AIDS are drug users who contracted the disease by sharing needles. There can be no doubt that the ravages of social breakdown, alienation, violence, and addiction will soon make vast and urgent claims on the attention and resources of Chinese authorities, academics, and health professionals. In the rush to emulate the Western world's achievements, many countries are neglecting to learn from the disruptions, dysfunctions, and diseases Western social models engender. Of all the groups affected by the forces of dislocation, none have been worse hit than minority populations such as the Australian Aborigines and North American Native peoples mentioned by Dr. DuPont and the descendants of black slaves brought to North America. Among the latter, people were separated not only from their places of origin, their cultures, and their communities, but often also from their immediate families. Long after the abolition of slavery, racial oppression and prejudice, along with economic deprivation, have continued to produce intolerable pressures on family life among many Afro-Americans, and the link to addiction is obvious. Equally obvious is the incitement of the drug trade to jobless and undereducated young black men, excluded from the economic promises of the American dream. The history of dispossession, exploitation, dislocation, and direct abuse of Native peoples on both sides of the 49th parallel is also too well known to require much discussion. Tobacco and other potentially addictive substances were available to North American natives prior to the European invasions, even alcohol in what are called now Mexico and the American Southwest, not to mention potentially addictive activities such as sex, eating, and gambling. Yet, as Dr. Alexander points out, there is no mention by anthropologists of anything that could be reasonably called addiction. Where alcohol was readily available, it was used moderately, often ceremonially rather than addictively. With the mass migration of Europeans to North America and the economic transformation of the continent came also the loss of freedom of mobility for Native peoples, the inexorable and still continuing despoliation and destruction of their homelands, the loss of their traditional livelihoods, the invalidation of their spiritual ways, persistent discrimination, and abject poverty. Within living memory, Native children were seized from their homes, alienated from their families, and for all intents and purposes, incarcerated in civilizing institutions where their lot was one of cultural suppression, emotional and physical maltreatment, and with distressing frequency, sexual abuse. It would be heartening to be able to say that our society has acknowledged its enormous historical, moral, and economic debt to its Native citizens. Although that has occurred sporadically, the overall pattern continues to be economic dispossession, denial of historical rights, and patronizing control. Canada, with our self-appointed mission to improve the health, education, and well-being of Afghans, has not even come close to securing those same essentials for our First Nation citizens. The living situations, health conditions, and social deprivation of many Canadian natives are abysmal even by third world standards. Under such circumstances, among tormented, dislocated, and most fundamentally disempowered people, pain and suffering are transmitted from one traumatized generation to the next. It is no accident that both Serena and her mother live in the same downtown Eastside Hotel on Hastings, nor are they the only mother-daughter Native pairing among my patients. Of any group in North America, whether in the U.S. or Canada, none can be said to be more psychologically and socially oppressed than Native women. Especially since working in the downtown East Side, I have often thought that if Canadian society ever apologized to our First Nations people for their dispossession and suffering, as we have to Japanese Canadians for their internment during World War II, our contrition would need to be vast, and our willingness to make restitution immensely generous. Perhaps that is why we have never accepted the responsibility. Dislocation continues to be an ever-accelerating feature of modern living, owing to rapid economic and social changes that human culture and human relationships cannot swiftly adapt to. The disruption of family life and the erosion of stable communities afflict many segments of society. Even the nuclear family is under severe pressure, with a high divorce rate and single-parent households, or in many cases, two parents having to work outside the home. For these endemic, cultural, and economic reasons, many children today who are not abused and who come from loving homes have lost their primary emotional attachment with the nurturing adults in their lives, with results disastrous for their development. As children become increasingly less connected to adults, they rely more and more on each other. A wholesale cultural subversion of the natural order of things. The natural order in all mammalian cultures, animal or human, is that the young stay under the wings of adults until they themselves reach adulthood. Immature creatures were never meant to bring one another to maturity. They were never meant to look to one another for primary nurturing, modeling, cue-giving, or mentoring. They are not equipped to act as one another's focus of orientation, to give one another a sense of direction or values. The predictable and widespread consequences of what my friend, psychologist Gordon Neufeld, has termed peer orientation are the increasing immaturity, alienation, violence, and precocious sexualization of North American youth. Another consequence is the entrenchment of addictive behaviors among young people. Research on both humans and animals has repeatedly demonstrated that extensive peer contact and the loss of adult attachments lead to a heightened propensity to addiction. Peer-reared monkeys, for example, are far more likely to consume alcohol than mother-reared ones. Peer affiliation, according to a review article in the journal Drug and Alcohol Dependence, is possibly the strongest social factor in predicting the onset and early escalation of adolescent substance use. It is commonly thought that peer affiliation leads to drug use because kids set bad examples for each other. That's part of the picture, but a deeper reason is that under ordinary circumstances, adolescents who rely on their peers for emotional acceptance are more prone to being hurt, to experiencing the sting of each other's immature and therefore often insensitive ways of relating. They are far more stressed than children who are well connected to nurturing adults. Kids are not cruel by nature, but they are immature. They taunt, tease, and reject. Those who have lost their orientation to adults and look to the peer group instead find themselves having to shut down emotionally for sheer protection. As we have seen with children abused at home, emotional shutting down, what Dr. Gordon Neufeld and I, in our book, Hold On to Your Kids, Why Parents Need to Matter More Than Peers, called the dangerous flight from feeling, greatly increases the motivation to use drugs. In short, the addiction process takes hold in people who have suffered dislocation and whose place in the normal human communal context has been disrupted. Whether they've been abused or emotionally neglected, are inadequately attuned children, or peer-oriented teens, or members of subcultures historically subjected to exploitation. To know the true nature of a society, it's not enough to point to its achievements, as leaders like to do. We also need to look at its shortcomings. What do we see then when we look at the drug ghetto of Vancouver's downtown east side and similar enclaves in other urban centers? We see the dirty underside of our economic and social culture, the reverse of the image we would like to cherish of a humane, prosperous, and egalitarian society. We see our failure to honor family and community life or to protect children. We see our refusal to grant justice to Aboriginal people. And we see our vindictiveness toward those who have already suffered more than most of us can imagine. Rather than lifting our eyes to the dark mirror held in front of us, we shut them to avoid the unsavory image we see reflected there. The Torah says that Aharon, the brother of Moses, was commanded to take two hairy goats and bring them before God. Upon each he was to place a lot, a marker. On one he was to place the lot of the people's sins, to effect atonement upon it, to send it away to Azazel into the wilderness. This was the scapegoat, who, cast out, must escape to the desert. The drug addict is today's scapegoat. Viewed honestly, much of our culture is geared towards enticing us away from ourselves, into externally directed activity, into diverting the mind from ennui and distress. The hardcore addict surrenders her pretense about that. Her life is all about escape. The rest of us can, with varying success, maintain our charade, but to do so, we banish her to the margins of society. Do not judge, and you will not be judged, a man of truth once said. For the judgments you give will be the judgments you will get, and the amount you measure out is the amount you will be given. Why do you observe the splinter in your brother's eye, and never notice the plank in your own? How dare you say to your brother, "Let me take the splinter out of your eye," when all the time there is a plank in your own? Take the plank out of your own eye first, and then you will see clearly enough to take the splinter out of your brother's eye. In the following chapters, we'll consider what our stance toward addiction might be if we took Jesus' words to heart. We'll see that his compassion integrates perfectly with what science has taught us about addiction. Chapter 24. Know Thine Enemy. Detective Sergeant Paul Gillespie, head of Toronto's Sex Crimes Unit, rescued children from the purveyors of internet pornography. As the Globe and Mail reported on his retirement from police work, 6 years at that job had not inured him to the horrors he witnessed. Paul Gillespie still can't get used to the sounds of crying and pain in the graphic videos of children being raped and molested that he has seen all too often on the web. "It's beyond horrible to listen to the soundtracks of these movies," said Canada's best-known child porn cop. "But it is the silent images of desolate children that tear most at his heart. They are not screaming, just accepting," he said of the infants captured in these pictures. "They have dead eyes. You can tell that their spirit is broken. That's their life." Dead eyes, broken spirits. In a phrase, this compassionate man summed up the fate of the abused child. Yet there is a bitter irony in his words. The lives of abused children do not end when they are rescued, if they are rescued, as most never are. Many become teenagers with spirits not mended, and reach adulthood with eyes still dead. Their fate continues to be a concern for the police and the courts, but by then they are no longer heartbreakingly sweet, no longer vulnerable-looking. They lurk on the social periphery as hardened men with ravaged faces, as thieves, robbers, shoplifters, as done-up prostitutes selling backseat sex for drugs or petty cash, as street-corner drug pushers or as small-time entrepreneurs distributing cocaine out of cheap hotel rooms. They are the hardcore injection users, and many will drift westward across Canada to the warmer climate and drug mecca of Vancouver's downtown east side. Here, as in cities across North America, it is now the duty of Detective Sergeant Gillespie's drug squad colleagues to keep a sharp eye on these people, to frisk them in back alleys, to confiscate their drug paraphernalia, and to arrest them time and again. Some of these former children are not pleasant to deal with. Scruffy and dirty, shifty and manipulative, they invite distaste. Fearful and contemptuous of authority at the same time, they evoke hostility. The police often handle them roughly. Cops are not necessarily predisposed to harshness, but a loss of humane interaction inevitably results whenever an entire group of people is delegitimized while another group is granted virtually unrestrained physical authority over them. I've had a small taste of it, having been stopped by the cops on my Hastings Street rounds, once for jaywalking and once for riding my bicycle on the sidewalk. An officer's tone shifts instantly from curt and contemptuous to polite when he realizes I'm not a downtown East Side resident. How utterly helpless I would feel, I have thought at such times, if I didn't have a respectable address on my driver's license, if I lived in a restricted, ghettoized domain where a uniformed and armed force was the omnipresent power, if I depended on substances the police had to suppress and on activities they were obliged to prosecute, if I couldn't count on reliable friends and family to advocate for me if I ever got into trouble. I have also witnessed officers treat my clients calmly and with kindness, but I know that's not the face they always turn toward the addict. The downtown East Side addicts are acutely aware of their lack of power in any conflict with authority, be it legal or medical. "Who would believe me? I'm just a junkie," is the refrain I hear over and over again as patients complain of being beaten in jail or on the darkened streets or of being dismissed rudely by nurses or doctors at an emergency ward. Such experiences for the addict add more links to the chain of utter powerlessness that began in childhood. With revolving door regularity, addicts are brought before the courts for crimes they commit to support their substance dependence. A few judges are mindful that addiction came upon these people as a defensive response to what they endured before their eyes went dead. Heroin for the pain, cocaine to enliven dulled spirits. Some judges will speak to them with compassion, urge them to reform, and offer them what narrow avenues of redemption our social and justice systems provide. Other judges appear to see them as society's evildoers and miscreants. Empathic judge or hanging judge, both are eventually compelled to send the addict criminal to prison. Incarcerated in institutions where fear and violence often rule, many will re-experience exactly what they suffered early in their lives and ever since, helplessness and isolation. While on the positive side, jail at times gives people a much-needed break from their compulsive drug use, on release, most of them will relapse into drug-taking and, of necessity, into the illegal acts required to sustain those habits. In any war, there must be enemies. In the war on drugs, the enemies are most often children, like the ones Detective Sergeant Gillespie could not rescue or rescued too late. They are not the generals, of course, the masterminds, or the profiteers. They are the foot soldiers, the ones who live in the trenches, and as in all wars, they are the ones who suffer and die. Or they become what the military calls collateral damage. The war on drugs, from the Hastings-facing window of the Portland Hotel, is manifested in the pregnant Celia, kneeling on the sidewalk, handcuffed wrists behind her back, eyes cast on the ground. There was no Detective Sergeant Gillespie to protect her when, as a little girl, she was raped by her stepfather and subjected to the nocturnal spitting ritual. So in the war on drugs, she has become one of the enemy. Also a foe in the war on drugs is 38-year-old Sean, who periodically disappears from my methadone practice. When he fails to show for his appointment, I know he's back in prison. He's a street dweller and petty thief, so his crimes never result in long jail terms. One time he was gone for nearly a year, but usually the absences last only weeks or months. Cocaine is his other habit, apart from narcotics, and like many others, he unwittingly began to use this chemical as self-medication for his undiagnosed and untreated attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. His recollection of school life is typical for ADHD. I was bored and restless, waiting and watching the clock until I could get out of the classroom. I felt like I was in a jail cell. I could never pay attention. In an attempt to help him establish a more stable life, his social worker recently sent Sean to my office with a detailed medical disability application, which, if approved, would get him off the street. It would be superfluous to tell Sean's life story. The reader will have some sense of it by now, but it is instructive to see how the enemy describes himself. With his permission, I reproduce here, precisely as he wrote them, the words Sean scribbled at the beginning of the disability form. In my opinion, my life as I know it to the truth. It started when I was about 11, 12 years old, and I was in the wrong crowd of people to associate with. Because of that, my life has been in jail for approx 18 years out of 37. From being where I have been and seen what I have seen was a big problem, and bad influence on my own life, and for example, at age of 18, seen a couple brutal murders happen within 7-8 yards, as well people committing suicide. Plus, I have now lived on Vancouver's worst streets. Skid Row and using IV drugs, heroin, cocaine. I've lived here homeless and in hotel rooms for 15 years minus all the jail time. I have hepatitis C from IV use. Plus, I've lost my ability to manage money because of addiction. I grew with an alcohol addiction from the he would physically beat my mom as was us kids. Because I'm physically addicted to methadone, I'm very limited to what I can make extra money from. Since all this has happened, I've lost a lot of self-esteem and get a mild paranoia from other peers, which I'm on medication for. This a brief opinion of why I need disability support. Thank you for your time. This man, with severe ADHD and learning disabilities, post-traumatic stress disorder, and deeply entrenched drug addiction, with no employment skills, with no history of successful human relationships, this is one of the culprits the police devote their time, skills, and energy to investigating and arresting, about whose misdeeds prosecutors versed in the law gather evidence, whom socially conscious and poorly recompensed legal aid defenders assist, and whom learned judges admonish and repeatedly incarcerate. Such is the war on drugs. Another foe, now dead, was the Vietnamese refugee Raymond, who wasted away from AIDS, steadfastly refusing treatment for years as the disease corroded his immune system and his health. I never found out much about his life, but there are other addicts in his family, and as far as we could tell, much pain and disconnection. Raymond had been an engineer before he succumbed fully to his addiction. In the downtown East Side, he survived by running a small-time cocaine operation. Lisa, the childlike crack addict depicted in Chapter 15, had been his client. She too is one of the enemy, and as such deserves to be known a little better. A glimpse into her world and her mind is given by a scrawled note she addressed to the dying Raymond. Once more, I reproduce the document exactly as written. Mr. Raymond R. I'm sorry for being a pain on your butt, but I'm just a drug addict who cannot help it on knocking on your door to ask you for help. If I'd do it again and again is because I keep my word to pay you, and you know that, right? I appreciate what you do for me very much. That is the reason why I respect you and pay you exactly what you give me. Sometimes you say I own you less, and I tell you the truth by letting you know I own you more. Raymond, you know I don't steal or cheat, especially to you, whom has given me the chance to prove to you that I did not use you or hurt you in any way. I never had hard feelings against you. Even do you, though I stole your money, I got hurt really bad. I could even end up dead just because I was Brock and a drug addict. You accuse me, it's okay, we all make mistakes, but why are you saying I don't pay you when I do? You know last time you accused me because you believe these girls. I hope this time you are accusing me in your own without being told what to do, because you are smart, intelligent enough to make your own decisions. Lisa's semi-literate plea to her drug pusher for understanding could be turned toward a larger issue. I believe that if all of us as individuals and as a society were smart, intelligent enough to make our own decisions, we would not punish the addict or wage a war in which human beings like Celia, Lisa, Sean, and Raymond are treated as the enemy. We would seek peace. As Lisa suggests, we all make mistakes. The war on drugs is one of them, as we'll next see. Chapter 25. Ignorance, Fear, Prejudice, and Profit. The Failed War on Drugs. After the onset of a war, when the patriotic fervor has faded to some degree, more sober considerations come to the fore. As this book goes to press, in Iraq there is no end in sight to extraordinary violence, and the roll call of American casualties grows ever longer. In the United States, the Iraq War has become increasingly unpopular. A diminished number of people support either its stated purposes or the strategy and tactics by which it is being pursued. Similarly, what the Canadian government calls Canada's mission in Afghanistan is under critical scrutiny at home as military and civilian casualties mount in that faraway land. The questions being raised about both conflicts are pertinent to any war, and are equally relevant to the war on drugs. Are the declared aims valid and attainable? Are the means employed likely to achieve the desired goals? What are the human and economic costs of carrying it out? Unlike the relatively recent interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, the war on drugs has been dragging on for many decades. Although the term was first coined in 1971 by Richard Nixon, its policies have been pursued with escalating force since the early years of the 20th century. Were we to apply objective measures, we would rapidly abandon both the rhetoric and the practices of this war. Were we to judge according to ethics and humane feeling, we would find the war abhorrent. The single most conspicuous feature of wars is violence, writes Bruce Alexander in his book, Peaceful Measures, Canada's Way Out of the War on Drugs. War mentality cleaves the world into noble allies and despicable enemies, and justifies any measures necessary to prevail, including violence, to innocent bystanders. In essence, war mentality suspends normal human compassion and intelligence. The question is not why the war on drugs is being lost, but why it continues to be waged in the face of all the evidence against it. Many factors are in play, some psychological, some broadly political, others economic, and yet others driven by the natural, if unfortunate, moralizing tendencies we human beings share. Fundamentalist religious beliefs especially engender judgmental attitudes toward perceived sinners. We may also consider that this war provided a cause to marshal people around at a time in the 1980s when the Soviet ogre had left the stage and the Muslim terrorist had yet to become the leading villain. In a society that habitually seems to find an enemy to loathe and fear, the addict serves as an ever-present candidate for the role. Given also the heavily disproportionate representation of minority peoples in prisons in almost all Western societies, and most particularly in the U.S., a punitive legal stance on drugs may also be seen as a form of imposing heavy-handed social control over disenfranchised and disaffected populations. According to Ethan Nadelman, executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance and Drug Policy Alliance Network, and arguably the foremost American advocate of saner approaches to the drug problem, the war mentality represents an unfortunate confluence of ignorance, fear, prejudice, and profit. Nadelman, a former professor at Princeton, said in a personal interview that the ignorance exists in its own right and is further perpetuated by government propaganda. The fear is that of ordinary people scared by misinformation, but also that of leaders who may know better, but are intimidated by the political costs of speaking out on such a heavily moralized and charged issue. The prejudice is evident in the contradiction that some harmful substances, alcohol, tobacco, are legal, while others, less harmful in some ways, are contraband. This has less to do with the innate danger of the drugs than with which populations are publicly identified with using the drugs, Nadelman points out. The whiter and wealthier the population, the more acceptable is the substance. And profit? If you have fear, prejudice, and ignorance, there will be profit, says Ethan Nadelman. Private prisons, politicians wanting private prisons operating, prison guard unions, it's all about people making money. Two, we have a treatment industry that relies on the justice apparatus to keep feeding a treatment system that is less about good medical care and rehabilitation than about enforced abstinence. To this list, we may add entire professions in the law enforcement and legal fields who rely on the drug war for their incomes and, indeed, for their very raison d'être. So perhaps, despite its incontrovertible failure, for some people, the war on drugs is a success after all. The want of compassion and intelligence that characterizes the war on drugs is self-evident, whether we look at its impact on my downtown Eastside patients or its vast numbers of casualties internationally, its destructive environmental effects in third world countries, or its staggering economic and social costs. For Canadians, it is helpful and even necessary to consider closely the U.S. experience of the war on drugs. Despite differences in political and social attitudes, Our two countries have broad cultural similarities. The U.S. government aggressively promotes its view of drug addiction internationally and brings enormous pressure on other countries to fall in line with its own opinions. Even if we in Canada have resisted adopting U.S. practices wholesale, American influence has been exerted against the institution of less restrictive measures here. As we'll see in Chapter 28, U.S. interference makes it very difficult for other countries, including Canada, to establish enlightened drug policies. It's beyond my purposes here to refute in detail the principles governing the U.S.-led war on drugs, or to document its global depredations. That information is readily available from, among others, high-level officials previously committed to prosecuting the war. One of them is Norm Stamper, former police chief of Seattle, who, after his retirement, has become an advocate of decriminalizing drugs. Chief Stamper writes, "Think of this war's real casualties. Tens of thousands of otherwise innocent Americans incarcerated. Many for 20 years, some for life. Families ripped apart. Drug traffickers and blameless bystanders shot dead on city streets. The United States has, through its war on drugs, fostered political instability, official corruption, and health and environmental disasters around the globe, due, for example, to the spraying of pesticides on large tracts of agricultural land to raise hemp or coca or opium crops. In truth, the U.S.-sponsored international war on drugs is a war on poor people, most of them subsistence farmers caught in a dangerous no-win situation. If the goal of the war on drugs is to discourage or prevent drug use, it has failed. Among young people in North America, drug use has reached unprecedented levels and enjoys unprecedented tolerance. According to figures quoted by Norm Stamper, the number of Americans who have used illegal drugs stands at 77 million. The U.S. Department of Justice reports that the number of prisoners has tripled, from 139 per 100,000 residents in 1980 to 476 per 100,000 in 2002. The vast majority being incarcerated after drug convictions. From 1980 to 1999, the annual number of Americans arrested for drug offenses nearly tripled, from 580,900 to 1,532,200. "That's a lot of enemies," comments the ex-police chief. If the war's purpose is to protect people and communities, or to improve their quality of life, it fails disastrously. As the personal histories of downtown Eastside addicts illustrate, and as statistics show, the human costs are devastating. One result, which is especially cruel and which will have a terrible impact on American life for many generations, is the large increase in the number of women incarcerated for drug violations, U.S. District Court Judge John T. Curtin has pointed out. From 1980 to 1996, there has been a 400% increase in the number of women prisoners. Many of those jailed for drug violations were mules or assistants. I venture that none was a principal organizer. Many are the mothers of small children who will be left without maternal care and most probably without any parental care at all. The engine of punitive punishment of mothers will haunt this nation for many years to come. If the war's aim is to end or even curtail the international drug trade, it has failed there too. If it is to suppress the cultivation of plants from which the major substances of abuse are derived, once again, abject failure. Truth, once again, is among the inevitable casualties of war. Official claims of victory in the war on drugs have been no more reliable than similar announcements about the conflict in Iraq. As a New York Times correspondent reported from Afghanistan, "A few weeks before I arrived in Helmand, John Walters, the director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, told reporters that Afghan authorities were succeeding in reducing opium poppy cultivation. Yet, despite hundreds of millions of dollars being allocated by Congress to stop the trade, a United Nations report in September estimated that this year's crop was breaking all records. 6,100 metric tons, compared with 4,100 last year." Not even in its Latin American backyard has Washington's war been more successful. Colombia has remained the world's largest cocaine producer, supplying 90% of the cocaine for the U.S. drug market, despite receiving more than $5 billion in anti-narcotics and counterinsurgency aid from the United States this decade, making it the largest recipient of American aid in the Southern Hemisphere, according to a report in the New York Times. Under conditions of extreme deprivation, people will continue to grow crops that promise economic relief, and they will continue to trade in those crops and their products. The ultimate beneficiaries are neither the impoverished Afghan or Colombian peasant, nor the street corner pusher in the U.S. ghetto or on Vancouver Skid Row. The illegality of mind-altering substances enriches drug cartels, crime syndicates, and their corrupt enablers among politicians, government officials, judges, lawyers, and police officers around the world. If one set out deliberately to fashion a legal system designed to maximize and sustain the wealth of international drug criminals and their abettors, one could never dream up anything to improve upon the present one, except perhaps to add tobacco to the list of contraband substances. That way, the traffickers and their allies could profit even more, although it's unimaginable that their legally respectable counterparts, tax-hungry governments, and the nicotine pushers in tobacco company boardrooms would ever allow that to happen. According to Dr. George Povey, professor of healthcare and epidemiology at the University of British Columbia, in 1995, illegal drugs caused 805 Canadian deaths, alcohol 6,507, and tobacco 34,728. So who's for a war on tobacco? He asks. A major study conducted on behalf of the British government in 2005 illustrated both the rich benefits that current drug legislation confers on major traffickers and the ludicrous impotence of law enforcement efforts against the drug trade. The profit margins for major traffickers of heroin into Britain are so high, they outstrip luxury goods companies such as Louis Vuitton and Gucci, reported The Guardian. The traffickers enjoy such high profits that seizure rates of 60-80% are needed to have any serious impact on the flow of drugs into Britain. But nothing greater than 20% has been achieved. Downing Street allowed only half the study's findings to be published, prompting an opposition spokesperson to argue, with reason, that what this report shows and what the government is too paranoid to admit is that the war on drugs is a disaster. We need an evidence-led debate about the way forward, but if they withhold the evidence, we can't have the debate. In North America, the situation is no different. The major reason why our society is awash in illicit drugs is the unbelievable profits that can be realized in their being manufactured and sold, writes Judge James P. Gray of the California Superior Court. It is the same in Canada. Dr. Povey points out that the billion Canadian bucks we throw at drug control each year have trivial effect upon supply, but powerfully inflate market value. A kilo of heroin that costs $3,000 in Pakistan sells for $150,000 on our streets, which explains why a serious drug user needs $50,000 spare change yearly to stay cool. The economic burden imposed by the war on drugs is difficult to estimate, but most authorities agree that in the U.S. it's in the range of tens of billions of dollars annually. Gary Becker, professor of economics and sociology at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business, has calculated $100 billion per year as a minimum figure. These estimates do not include important intangible costs, such as the destructive effects on many inner-city neighborhoods, the use of the American military to fight drug lords and farmers in Colombia and other nations, or the corrupting influence of drugs on many governments. How such expenses in support of a failed policy can be justified is beyond imagining in a country where the poverty rate is increasing and where in some areas the rising infant mortality rate is comparable to third world figures. Although the war has not been prosecuted as ferociously in Canada, were our costs to be collated, they would still be egregious at a time when healthcare, education, and social welfare conditions have all deteriorated owing to diminished government funding. An unintended but tragic consequence of the international campaign against narcotics is that through much of the underdeveloped world, opiates are not available for soothing physical pain. Countless human beings, from infancy to old age, live and die in pain. According to the World Health Organization, nearly 5 million people a year with advanced cancer receive inadequate or no pain relief, along with another 1.4 million with late-stage AIDS. The WHO has no statistics for those suffering pain owing to a host of other causes, from injuries to diseases of all sorts. The problem? An exaggerated fear of addiction. Pain relief hasn't been given as much attention as the war on drugs. David E. Jorensen, director of the Pain Policy Study Group at the University of Wisconsin's Medical School, told the New York Times. Finally, if the purpose of the war is to deter substance use by drug desperados, such as the ones who inhabit Vancouver's downtown east side, the very idea of its success is laughable. Drugs do not make the addict into a criminal. The law does. When alcohol was prohibited, drinkers were breaking the law. If cigarettes were illegal, there would be a huge underground market for tobacco products. Gangs would form, criminal business empires would flourish, and smokers would be spending a large proportion of their income on nicotine-containing substances. Add the health ravages and medical and economic costs of nicotine addiction, the hundreds of thousands of deaths it causes, and the many family tragedies it already creates, and then factor in the enormous cost of waging the war on drugs on yet another front. The result would be a monumentally costly and futile effort. We have been, and will always be, totally unsuccessful in our attempts to repeal the law of supply and demand, writes James P. Gray in his book, Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed. We might as well try to repeal the law of gravity. As Judge Gray documents in his persuasive critique, subtitled A Judicial Indictment of the War on Drugs, most of the social harm related to drugs does not come from the effects of the substances themselves, but from legal prohibitions against their use. Quite apart from the multiple billions squandered on this futile war, the economic burdens of criminalization are incalculable, as we may glimpse from the daily pursuits of my own patients. Several have blown through large inheritances in short order, $70,000 over the course of a few weeks in the case of one woman, an inveterate cocaine and heroin addict, now terminally ill in her early 50s. Such windfalls are rare, leaving crime, panhandling, and prostitution as the common sources of drug money. Drug dealing can range from the petty to the extensive, but in the downtown east side there are few profiteers. Most who engage in it do so only to fuel their own habits. 2 years ago I got back into dealing, one man told me recently. I was making $19,000 a month. All gone. Not a penny. Except for the $10,000 I gave to the mother of my little son. It went on for 10 months, so I made $190,000. And I walked away with $10,000. It's a snap to spend that kind of money. Typically, the $100 or $300 habits a day are mostly cocaine as opposed to heroin, because heroin is so cheap. You can get a quarter gram of really, really good heroin for only $30, and I don't care how bad your habit is, on $30 worth, nobody needs to be sick. Sick here means to go through withdrawal. But with cocaine, that's an easy $300 or $500 or $700 a day. Now, when it comes to selling stolen goods, you're lucky if you get 10% on the value. I've seen a $2,000 bicycle go for $25 worth of rock cocaine. So typically, if somebody is generating $300 a day, he's probably stealing $3,000 worth of stuff. Yeah, you're lucky if you get 10%. In the privacy of my office, many people are remarkably candid about how they find the cash to fund their drug habit. McDermott, a 40-year-old with sunken eyes, gaunt features, and a perpetual smirk on his face, is even boastful as he tells me of his piratical exploits. What? I say incredulously. How much did you say? That's what they estimated in court, that I stole $2,700,000 over the course of 2.5 years. That's just impossible. Well, that was their estimate. McDermott does his thievery at the Port of Vancouver, where container ships are moored. He and a buddy worked out a system for stealing goods from the ships without being picked up by security. Among other things, they steal cigarettes and get into containers with expensive Asian clothing, long-sleeved silk shirts for men, women's fancy dresses. Other ingenious schemes McDermott has participated in involved stealing aluminum from construction sites and siphoning gasoline from big trucks. I ask him where he sells this stuff. He shrugs. I used to deal with Larry, but they killed Larry. He got murdered. He used to say, fuck, McDermott, at least cut these in half. I get a bunch of fucking aluminum, I phone a wheelchair taxi pulls up, we put in 300 pounds of aluminum. I usually make $210, minus 30 for the cab. That's 180 bucks. For many addicts, crime becomes a necessary part of life. Automatic, reflexive, to be taken for granted. One morning, I marched up to a patient's room to retrieve an expensive leather coat. He'd stolen it half an hour earlier during a medical visit at a colleague's office. The doctor phoned me in an agitated state right after this man had left. I just turned my back for a moment, he said. The patient was apologetic, but not overly remorseful. I couldn't help it, he pleaded. It was lying on his chair. What could I do? What could I do was also the defense of another patient, Mike, who pocketed my Palm Pilot one day when I left him sitting in my office for no more than 20 seconds. It was during my early days at the Portland. I'd stepped into the next room to pick up a prescription pad. I naively believed that this man, who once made me a finely worked wood carving to express his gratitude, could be trusted. Perhaps he could be trusted, but his addiction could not. 5 minutes after he left, I noticed the empty space on my desk where the Palm Pilot had been. I shut the office, reassured the waiting patients that I'd be back shortly, and hurried down the block to Mike's hotel. It took a few sharp knocks before he opened the door. I want it back, I said. What? He replied. Look, Mike, you have two options. You return my Palm Pilot immediately, or immediately I call the police. Mike slumped on his bed, a defeated look on his face. Okay, first thing tomorrow. No, first thing right now. I don't have it, Mike said. Then find it. We walked down the stairs of the Sunrise Hotel together and entered the pawn shop around the corner. I need that Palm Pilot back, Mike announced to the owner. It belongs to this guy. The pawnbroker feigned shock. What you mean? He cried. Quite obviously, or so his body language implied, this was the first time ever that here, on the East Hastings Drug and Crime Strip, anyone had tried to pass stolen goods at his establishment.
Why you no tell me it wasn't yours? He said, in a tone of reproach.
As the owner picked out my item from among a pile of electronic devices, Mike shuffled about, not seeming the least bit comfortable. It was there on your desk, he explained as we left the store. What could I do? There are thousands of destitute, hardcore drug addicts in Vancouver's downtown east side alone. Knowing that many of them have to steal, shoplift, scam, and panhandle hundreds of dollars a day to sustain their habits, we can begin to compute the economic hit our society is taking in service of the arbitrary principle that people may poison themselves with alcohol or kill themselves with cigarette-derived toxins, but those whose drug of choice is a narcotic or a stimulant are to be considered criminals. Undeterred by the miserable failure of its war on drugs, the U.S. administration has taken upon itself to oppose decriminalization and harm reduction programs anywhere on the globe. In April 2006, the Mexican Senate approved a bill to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana, cocaine, heroin, and other drugs for personal use. The office of President Vicente Fox signaled his willingness to pass the bill into law. We can't close our eyes to this reality, said Senator Jorge Zermeno of Fox's conservative National Action Party. We cannot continue to fill our jails with people who have addictions. It took less than 24 hours of U.S. advice for the Mexican government to change its mind. The measure was sent back for further study which is to say, to its legislative grave. Some political leaders in Ottawa welcome the hardline mentality emanating from Washington. In December 2006, under the headline